This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. In the week following the US presidential election, we've seen concerted disinformation campaigns on social media, seeking to undermine public confidence in the vote and urging people to take to the streets in protest. So what's the verdict on how companies like Facebook and Twitter have dealt with this? And what approach might Joe Biden's new government take to them following constant criticisms from his campaign that they haven't done enough to stop the spread of harmful fake news and baseless conspiracy theories? I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, I'll be discussing these issues with Dr. Mike Carpenter, formerly foreign policy advisor to Joe Biden and currently managing director of the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. In the Obama administration, he served in the Pentagon as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense, with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, and the Balkans. He's also written extensively on Russian malign influence operations in the Western world. We'll be hearing as well from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Mike Carpenter, it's great to have you on the Infotagen podcast. We're recording this the week after the presidential election in America, and there's a huge amount to talk about. There's been an incredibly tight focus on the performance of the big social media companies, I think particularly Facebook, in dealing with disinformation. No one wanted to see a repeat of the foreign interference that was part of the 2016 presidential election. And in this campaign, I think there's been a big focus on how well they've acted against disinformation, whether they've removed it effectively enough. And I wonder what your thoughts were, as we are sort of just a week or so after polling day. How well do you think the companies performed in the run-up to the election, and crucially in the days after it?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you, Damien, and thanks for this opportunity. To answer your question, I've been enormously disappointed with the tech companies, and particularly with Facebook, for how slowly it's reacted to the egregious disinformation appearing on its platform, both before the election, in the run-up to the election, and now in the post-election period, where I think that the disinformation is, in fact, at a fever pitch with regards to the legitimacy of the elections, questioning that legitimacy, and really questioning the integrity of our democratic institutions. And Facebook has been slow. They have left a lot of disinformation on their platforms. And it's really appalling. They haven't taken action with regards to some of the Russian stuff that was appearing before the election, or more accurately, Ukrainian stuff that had Russian origins. Facebook did take some of that down, but I think they were more interested in scoring a few PR points than in really undertaking a thorough effort to scrape disinformation, especially toxic disinformation, from their site.
Yeah, I mean, from what you say, I think it sounds like you feel that the company only acts when it's sort of publicly shamed into doing so, and then when it does act is always much later than it should have been, and often when the harm's already been done.
That's exactly right. And Facebook and Twitter have, adopted, well, Twitter especially has adopted this practice of putting labels on tweets, which, again, it's sort of a PR move. It seems like it's taking action, but really it doesn't disincentivize people from clicking on those tweets. In fact, maybe just the opposite. It's kind of like, putting a parental advisory on an album. Teenagers will immediately go out and flock to that album cover and buy it. I think a lot of these steps are pro forma to be seen as doing something, when in fact, look at Steve Bannon's call for beheading of two very prominent Americans, the director of the FBI and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the head of the Infectious Diseases Institute at the National Institute of Health. I mean, that's just appalling that Facebook would allow that post from Steve Bannon to remain on site for 10 hours before taking it down. And even today, a lot of Bannon-linked sites remain up on Facebook. They have just been very slow to act.
I think that's really important because, Facebook often say they will act when disinformation is posted, which could cause harm rather than just being opinions that people dispute. And that's a real example where someone is calling for harm to be caused. And also we've seen, film of
people taking to the streets in response to the Steve Bannon sort of backed Stop the Steal campaign trying to undermine the legitimacy of the election.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they claim that a lot of their work is now powered by artificial intelligence and that it is seamless and instantaneous. But in fact, when you see stuff like this up for 10 hours, I mean, it causes enormous damage. By that time, it's already spread. As, you know, those folks who study disinformation know, you've got to act very quickly because once it's out there in the public arena, then it has a life of its own. So very disappointing.
Now, obviously, during the campaign, there was a bit of discussion about Facebook's role, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, and I was particularly interested in Joe Biden making Facebook a bit of an issue of his campaign. In London, the Financial Times has reported that Bill Russo, the head of press of the Biden campaign, responded to a tweet from Sacha Baron Cohen, the British comedian and filmmaker, which showed a picture of Donald Trump meeting Mark Zuckerberg. And on that, Sacha had commented, "One down, two to go." And Bill had responded, "Hell yes." And do you think we're going to see a very different sort of approach to the big tech companies from a Biden administration?
Well, you know, I think there is a lot of frustration on the Biden team with Facebook in particular, but with the tech companies in general. Bill lives this every day because he works on the Biden communications team. And, you know, he has an interesting thread up on Twitter just yesterday, precisely talking about how a lot of this post-election day disinformation, calling for violence and questioning the integrity of the vote remains up. And it's, you know, it's frustrating because this stuff gets brought to Facebook and it gets pointed out and they're just so slow. And then when they do take steps, it's always small steps. And there's a reason for this, Damien. I mean, the fundamental reality is that, you know, all of these tech companies' business model is based on the spread of salacious, you know, false and toxic content. I mean, that's it. That's how they make money. And so obviously they have a disincentive from taking quick action to root out this kind of disinformation because it goes against their business model. And we shouldn't be surprised to see this happen again and again and again.
There seems to be, I mean, I've been very interested in the debate in America on what was known as Section 230, the American laws that give the platforms protection from liability for harmful content on there. And it would seem that for different reasons, there are now lots of voices in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party who want to see reform of this. And I suppose if you boil it all down, the key thing seems to be that whatever your views on what content should or shouldn't be allowed on social media, it shouldn't just be down to Mark Zuckerberg to decide.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, there continues to be this false sense out there that, frankly, it's a false narrative that is spread by the tech companies themselves, that they are enabling free speech and a robust discussion. Now, I think actually of all people, Sacha Baron Cohen really took down that false narrative, probably most effectively of anyone I've ever seen, by arguing, you know, these are platforms where not everything should be allowed, just like not all newspapers publish whatever op-eds are sent their way. You know, they have to discern. The platforms also have to discern in terms of what they allow to go up. At certain types of toxic disinformation calls for violence. And especially now in this very fraught post-election period, calls for violence, for inciting hatred against election officials are completely inappropriate. And so, yes, this is a big issue. You know, tech regulation is not my beat. I do foreign policy, but I think it's something that a Biden administration will likely look very closely at.
I think we'll be really interested to see what the administration propose. I mean, Nick Clegg has been interviewed on the radio in the UK today. We'll see now. Plays a senior role in communications at Facebook, having previously been Deputy Prime Minister of the UK. He was saying he thought that if the Senate isn't under Democrat control, that the White House might have difficulty in pushing through reform at pace. I know this isn't your direct area of interest, but do you think that's likely, or do you think the administration could still move quite fast on this if they wanted to?
You know, I think there may be some Republicans who are interested in tech regulation as well. So I don't know that that's necessarily the case. And by the way, I just have to say, because this narrative often appears among various different sources, there is no clear indication that Republicans will, in fact, control the Senate. Joe Biden is up by, I think it's now around 12,000 votes in the state of Georgia. So Georgia is likely to go his way. And there are two Senate races there that are headed for a runoff on January 5th. If the Democrats win those two senatorial races, they will have 50 seats in the Senate, and Vice President Kamala Harris will be the tiebreaker. So the Democrats may well have control of the two branches of Congress.
Absolutely. So there's still plenty of voting to be done before we know where we are on this. As you said, your area of expertise in particular in terms of foreign policy, where both in your work at the Pentagon and the Obama administration and advising Joe Biden himself when he was vice president, that has been focused on Russia. And disinformation as an act of aggression and disruption is something that's been very closely associated with Russia. We've seen evidence of it from the 2016 presidential campaign. We've seen evidence of it again through COVID and in disinformation about COVID and its sources, and in particular the likely success of vaccines. Before we talk about those particular issues, do you think there's been much evidence of, to your mind, of Russian interference in the recent presidential election?
Well, there clearly is evidence of Russian disinformation operations surrounding this election. How important those are, or how significant their effect is as compared to organic domestic disinformation, is something that I think we'll have to study in the weeks to come. My own sense is, in fact, my sense prior to the election itself, was that Russia was going to be primarily in the role of amplifying all the virulent disinformation that was being put forward by what we call the alt-right media ecosystem here in the United States, the Daily Callers, the Breitbarts, all those sorts of portals that are full of conspiracy theories and lies. Why would Russia, resource up an operation based out of, say, a troll farm in St. Petersburg, where they're paying individuals with poor English skills to try to spread disinformation, when all they need to do is, make some anonymous donations, potentially, to some of these sites and watch them just sort of flourish and spread disinformation left and right. So I think we've seen more of the amplification of what already exists than the sort of manufactured out of whole cloth misinformation that we saw in the 2016 cycle coming from places like Macedonia and St. Petersburg.
I'd be interested to know how sophisticated you think these operations are. And in particular, because I saw from some of the recently unsealed documents from the Mueller investigation, that it looked like it suggested that some of Cambridge Analytica's data targeting sets from the 2016 Trump campaign had made their way to people in the Ukraine via Paul Manafort. And that would be concerning if potentially operatives in Russia were gaining insights on how to target American voters based on work that was done during a presidential election.
Well, indeed. And I can't imagine there was any other reason why Paul Manafort, who was then in 2016, Trump's campaign manager, would have passed proprietary polling data from the campaign to a now known Russian spy, Konstantin Kalimnik, other than to give the Russians and pro-Russian Ukrainians a sense of where to target their efforts. I mean, I just simply can't imagine any other reason for that. And especially now that the Senate's bipartisan intelligence report has concluded definitively that Kalimnik was not just tied to Russian intelligence, but was a Russian intelligence agent. I think we have to look back on that information and see it for what it was.
Absolutely. I mean, we will soon be talking on the Infotainment podcast to Elizabeth Denham, the Information Commissioner in the UK. And I know one of the things that they looked at in their investigation of Cambridge Analytica was whether sources in Russia had access to cloud stored Cambridge Analytica data, which again would be concerning and beg the question as to who was accessing that and for what purpose. there's been the focus on COVID disinformation coming from Russia and Iran, and something that the UK government is taking seriously too. In some ways, I think COVID disinformation has helped people focus on the issue, because whilst some people might say, well, they don't think they'd ever be swayed in their political opinions by something they saw on Facebook, with something like COVID, which is something that's new and comes along, we've seen extraordinary behaviour, including in the UK, people setting fire to mobile phone masts because they were persuaded that 5G mobile signals would cause coronavirus. I mean, have you looked at the Russian interference in COVID and the way they've sought to exploit that to create tensions and undermine confidence in governments in the West?
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is an area where the Russians have been very active. You know, even prior to the pandemic, before anyone knew what the coronavirus was, the Russians were very active in trying to tap into the anti-vax community, the anti-vaccine community online, and that morphed very quickly into tapping into COVID misinformation networks. But you know, there is a debate here in the U.S., and I think it's a valid one, about just how effective this Russian effort is when compared with the monstrosity of what we're seeing coming from the president of the United States. And I know that sounds like a very partisan statement, but you had a president of the United States who did go in front of the cameras and say on live TV that people should ingest bleach and that perhaps, you know, putting sunlight into their bodies would cure them of COVID. And he was hawking hydroxychloroquine as a treatment, as a remedy, potentially prophylactic, when it's been proven not to have any meaningful effect. And so you just have to ask yourself, is all this Russian stuff really amounting to all that much, even though it is certainly happening, as compared with, you know, a platform like the president of the United States, who has, you know, 88 million Twitter followers, and of course the attention of the world's media. So it's a valid debate, but there is no doubt that Russia's playing in this sandbox as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you said, that at the moment they can amplifying content created from within a country like America or the UK is easier than having to create it yourself, and there are plenty of groups to do that. I mean, do you think they obviously, you know, Donald Trump's tweets speak for themselves, as his press people always say. But do you think the Russians are looking to seed information into, or seed doubt into groups that they know will then amplify it for them?
Yeah, what I see is one of the most dangerous modes of disinformation that the Russians are promoting is the QAnon conspiracy, which has a sort of a violent tone to it in terms of a lot of the content that we find amongst those groups, calling for, you know, overthrow of sitting governors of U.S. states, as well as opposition to federal law enforcement and the federal government writ large. And that is the perfect type of group of people that the Russians like to be able to amplify and, you know, accelerate their communications. So I have no doubt, I haven't done myself detailed studies, I've seen some other people working on this, but I have no doubt that the Russians are very actively helping to promote the QAnon conspiracy in the United States, which has gone from being, you know, something that was completely on the fringes, just sort of a Mad Hatter, insane sounding group of conspiracies back in 2017, to being a movement that now wrapped up 70 congressional candidates. And now there's even going to be a sitting member of the House of Representatives who fully embraces this conspiracy.
I mean, this is extraordinary in a way. I suppose the QAnon movement was born out of a well-known piece of disinformation from 2016 about the pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., and a persistent sort of claim that there's a paedophile ring linked to senior Democrats and Hollywood stars and various other sort of global influencers. And as you say, it's extraordinary that this bizarre and very unpleasant splinter movement has suddenly gained the attention of so many people. It would seem that without social media, that wouldn't have been possible.
Oh, no, this is absolutely impossible to imagine in the era before social media. This is all algorithmically driven by the platforms. You know, you go onto YouTube and you click on, say, something that is vaguely cautious about use of vaccines, and then all of a sudden your feed piles up with suggestions for other conspiracy theories to include things like QAnon. And so, the algorithms literally hook people who are vulnerable onto other conspiracy theories that they might not even have known about. And that just creates this exponential spread, as we've seen with QAnon. And it's really, really dangerous.
Yeah, I think it demonstrates as well that the effect that these sorts of campaigns can have, because some people say, well, how influenced are people by what they see on social media? But I think the QAnon movement is a horrific example of what people can be led into.
Absolutely. And the Russians understand this very well. These are the sorts of things that they've been promoting for years. And the fact that QAnon has gone global, it's in the UK, it's in Germany, it's in France, perhaps to lesser degrees than it is in the United States, but it does exist in many different countries around the world. And this must be music to Russia's ears, because this is precisely the sort of violent, uncivil society that they try to promote to break down democratic norms and institutions. That's their playbook. That's what they're after.
And I think that's in some ways what is increasingly concerning, because whilst we've been talking about the disinformation, the role of Russia in disinformation, focused on COVID in the last year, and in particular on the presidential election, it would be wrong to believe that this is just going to go away, that the attempt to exacerbate divisions in society and undermine confidence in governments will continue. And I would imagine in America, they will do everything they can to try and undermine the new administration when it takes shape.
Absolutely. And you've seen how these various disinformation campaigns have morphed with time. You yourself alluded to the fact that QAnon grew out of the Pizzagate conspiracy. Pizzagate was, of course, completely discredited, and now it's no longer widely quoted or talked about, but it gave birth almost literally to QAnon, just as the birther movement that President Trump embraced with reference to the fact that he claimed President Obama was not born in the United States, sort of morphed into this racist questioning of the legitimacy of African-American elected leaders in the United States. And so I have no doubt that some of the conspiracy theories that we see today, perhaps associated with COVID, or who knows, maybe with something else, will morph over time into conspiracies that are against a Biden administration, that make it more difficult for them to govern.
And I think, Donald Trump, when asked about QAnon, say there were people who loved America?
Right. And, and he very consciously shies away from condemning them, and, claims not to know what they are, which is evidently foolish. Clearly, he does know exactly what they are. But, he they are the sort of the pro-Trump ultra base in the United States. And so, of course, he is not going to discredit them or condemn them. And that just gives them more oxygen to be able to spread and gain adherence.
I'd just like to bring in Charles Creel, who's with us again at this point. I mean, Charles, you've been monitoring the events in America from Fairhope, Alabama for us. And the last time we spoke was a few days before polling day. And you said then you were concerned about what the week after the election would be like. And how are you seeing things at the moment?
Well, I am still concerned about that. Thanks, Damien. It's good to be back. We are having a unique election in American history, as Mike's been pointing out. But there's also a lot of extraordinary reactions on social media websites, which are coming under a lot of deserved scrutiny for the way they're spreading disinformation, particularly in this moment. For example, both during and since the election, Twitter has been labeling several of Donald Trump's tweets as containing false information. And this is an extraordinary moment in the relationship between media and politics. There was also an incredibly predictable yet unique moment that happened when all four major networks cut away from President Donald Trump during a press conference. One cut away within 2 minutes and citing specifically his spread of disinformation disinformation. After Trump's loss at the polls and following this disinformation spread from Trump, many of his followers, believing the counting of mail-in ballots was election fraud, have joined a Stop the Steal movement. It's hashtag Stop the Steal. And the groups initially lived on Facebook and Twitter. They gained hundreds of thousands of followers just after the election. And they were pushing false claims that Biden bragged about committing voter fraud, that poll workers have been secretly filling out ballots for him. Ultimately, Facebook banned one of the larger Stop the Steal groups because they were inciting violence. And in response to this, members have now turned to other channels of media so they can carry on the conversation and organize events like the Stop the Steal protests outside the state capitol buildings that happen on the Saturday following Election Day. One of those channels they've turned to is Parler, which experienced its largest day of downloads on November 8th, the day after Election Day. Back to the protests, though, they're being organized by a right-wing political commentator, and I'm being generous by describing him that way, named Ali Akbar, who now goes by the name of Ali Alexander. Alexander registered the Stop the Steal website just last week, and he manages their mailing list, which is already up and running. He's been banned from Twitter, but despite that, Jack Dorsey consulted him when he was debating whether to ban Alex Jones. Now, Alexander has publicly threatened the life of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So this, it's not a great guy we're talking about here. So Stop the Steals, or Alexander's first protest, was largely peaceful. That's that Saturday after the Election Day, and pretty poorly attended. But it's worth noting that several people across the country showed up in open carry mode. They sported AR-15s and other semi-automatic combat rifles. Now, what's worrying me now is that another Stop the Steal event is planned for November 14th. And now another social platform has begun promoting these events, and that's Daily Stormer. Daily Stormer is America's go-to neo-Nazi news site, and it's a watering hole for paramilitary insurgency groups like the one that staged the armed occupation of the Michigan State Capitol building earlier this year. Daily Storm has begun featuring full pages that not only lay out the goals of Stop the Steal, but also list the upcoming protests, which are taking place at state capitol buildings, and they're listing the addresses of all of these. They also sadly make the point that Stop the Steal Facebook page was recently shut down, quote, by the Jews. The site's a really nasty piece of work. It also features a lot of graphics indicating that the white population of the United States will be below 50% in the U.S. in 23 years. And this seems to be fueling a lot of the heat that's out there. But given the violent racist outbreaks we've seen in the U.S. over the election cycle, it's probably a good thing. Meanwhile, Trump and his enablers seem willing to continue to stir things up. So I am still very worried about the coming weeks.
Absolutely, no. It's a very concerning picture that you paint. I mean, as Mike's with us, I thought you should say, I saw you tweeted about what happened when you you Googled the Penn Biden Center, where Mike is managing director.
Yes, indeed. I Googled the Penn Biden Center, and I was immediately taken to a webpage of pure Trump anti-Biden propaganda, accusing the Penn Biden Center of all sorts of illegalities. And it's, to me, that was right at this for my receipt, because it may be different for everybody else, but right at the top of interesting stories on Google was that story. So they have a lot to answer to, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, this disinformation is now really accelerating. And what's really remarkable, you mentioned a number of the mainstream networks cut away from that Trump speech, but you also had Kayleigh McEnany, the president's spokesperson, the other day, and Fox was carrying her remarks, and she started to speak to stolen ballots and ballot fraud. And to its credit, the Fox News Network cut away immediately, and the host, Neil Cavuto, you know, he said, whoa, 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 we're not going to be covering this unless she can substantiate her claims, which of course she didn't. And that, you know, that was an interesting moment for me. It shows that, you know, Fox can turn on a dime when it wants to, when it has the will. it can act responsibly. And you know, my sense is that Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News, has decided that, you know, he's not going to tolerate this, at least not to the degree that he has up till now, coming from his own network. But the stuff online, of course, is its own separate ecosystem, and that continues to spread. You mentioned the Stop the Steal Facebook page was taken down, but then immediately, you know, dozens of other copycat pages or surrogate pages popped up. So it's sort of a game of whack-a-mole, unfortunately.
I mean, Mike, I mean, what do you think? What do you feel it's going to take to get on top of this problem? And we had David Cicilline on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about the antitrust committee report that his majority group on his committee published, and that report highlights just how badly, as a consequence of the ad domination of the Google and Facebook, that local news has been hollowed out in America. Certainly, the case in the UK. Legitimate, well-sourced, reliable sources of news are being squeezed out, and increasingly what people see as news is what they see in their newsfeed on Facebook. I mean, what do you think it's going to take for us to get on top of this problem?
Well, you know, I think that's part of it, is regulation and looking at antitrust. But then there's also, you know, at the root of this is this sort of algorithmically driven toxicity that that needs to be changed. And it's, as I said earlier, it's sort of inextricably tied to these tech platforms' business models. So I honestly don't have the answer in terms of how you allow them to continue to make money by serving as a platform for people to connect with each other, which in theory should be a good thing, but then stopping these algorithms that drive people towards toxic sort of hate speech and other forms of, you know, incitement of civil unrest. That has to be stopped. And that's where the platforms are so woefully behind.
And before we wrap up our discussion, I just wanted to ask another sort of slightly more Russia-specific question. Is whilst, you know, we're all distracted with these very important issues and this very important election, how do you think the situation will play out between Russia and Belarus?
Well, you know, I am of the view that Russia, the Kremlin, understands that Lukashenko has no legitimacy left, and they will eventually move him aside. I think for the moment, they want to try to demobilize the pro-democracy movement. And so they are going to continue with torture and repressions and standing by Lukashenko for now. But what I predict for you is that the Kremlin is going to do what it does best, which is sort of political subterfuge and sabotage. And you will see that there will be constitutional reforms announced that put more power into the Belarusian parliament, which up until now has been a rubber stamp. And that institution, through the growth of pro-Kremlin puppet parties, will become an alternative power center to Lukashenko. So that if, you know, Lukashenko's successor at some point in the future is not towing the Kremlin's line, they will have those parties in parliament to be able to change, you know, the folks in power when they want. And so I think you're going to see a move towards quote unquote constitutional reforms and quote unquote dialogue with the opposition that will be anything but democratic reforms and anything but a real dialogue with the real opposition. It'll all be stage managed from the Kremlin. So, you know, I would expect something along those lines going forward.
And do you think we'll see sort of more activity from the disinformation playbook the Russians have exploited in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Russians have sent in TV anchors from their own networks into Belarus to manage the Belarusian TV stations. They have deployed vast numbers of media consultants and disinformation experts, not just from the presidential administration, but also within the network of pro-Putin oligarchs like Konstantin Malafeyev, who is one of the major funders of the Tsargrad TV, for example, which is a very far-right pro-Putin TV station in Russia. So these people have descended on Belarus, and they are now pumping out lots of pro-Kremlin and anti-Western disinformation left and right.
So another important issue that we've all got to keep focused on as well. Mike and Charles, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damian Collins, featuring Mike Carpenter and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagenPodcast. Infotagen is a not-for-profit organisation, and all proceeds will go towards the making of this show. Thank you until next time.